I do appreciate very much the opportunity to participate in this workshop, and I really commend the organizers and the ITP for their leadership in the past few years in bringing theorists together and interfacing with observers on problems of black hole astrophysics. I'm going to give you the punchline in advance, which is basically that we have a sense of states now in black hole binaries, where each state represents what I think is a essentially different system, different energetics, substantially different geometric conditions in the emitting regions, different physics. And QPOs are not for free. They imply an organization in the way radiation is expressed, and therefore they provide an opportunity to solve problems, particularly in view of the fact that two of the three states involve non-thermal processes that we don't fully understand. I'm going to try to review all that. I'll first give you a status report on black hole binaries to get us going. And then I'll talk about X-ray states and the connection between states and QPOs. And I think that the context of states is really important in really showing what the ultimate power is, diagnostic power, that QPOs represent. I'll describe the properties of low-frequency QPOs, the properties of high-frequency QPOs, and then I'll try to summarize some observational challenges for jet theory and GRMHD. So, just to review the basics, X-ray astronomy plays a role in locating black holes in the galaxy. I think it's still true that 100% come from X-ray astronomy. We're trying to measure the properties of the black holes, mass and spin, and QPOs can help us in this process, particularly in trying to get reliable measures eventually of this dimensional spin parameter. We want to understand accretion physics, and that involves what I have already described, the different elements and structures in each state, and that includes jets. And our sense of what are the primary variables involved in the process of black hole radiation has become much more sophisticated and expanded. It certainly is not true that it all scales as a function of m dot. And so the mass of the black hole, the spin, the inclination between the disk and the angular momentum of the black hole, the mass accretion rate, outflow, any global B magnetic field, and perhaps the beta value of the plasma, all of these are probably important, or at least as evidence, they're much more important than was realized before XTE. Now, given the volume of XTE data, there are many recent reviews and global studies that are available in the literature, and I recommend interested people take a look at all of these on either published or on AstroPH. So I don't need to belabor the part where we find black holes in the galaxy by looking at the companion star and essentially looking at dynamical motions and inferring the mass of the black hole. And they are in the range of 4 to 18 solar masses. And we call them black holes, and what we're really referring to is their mass is beyond the theoretical limit for the mass of a neutron star. Now, the statistics of what we have available, there are 20 dynamical black hole binaries now, and we define black hole candidates as sources that resemble the black holes, but in terms of having no pulsations, no bursts, and the properties of black hole binaries and their spectra and timing, but we can't see the companion star well enough to do any dynamical measurements, and hence we can't get the mass. Now, one more detail I'd like to point out here is that if you score how many of the dynamical black holes are transients and how many of the black hole candidates are transients, you'll see that 37 out of 41 are transient X-ray sources. And so this creates a situation that to do meaningful analysis and observations, there are two dimensions of targets of opportunity. First of all, due to the fact that these black holes are transient sources, and secondly, due to the fact that they wander in different X-ray states, and you can't really do coherent analysis in astrophysics unless you do state-specific investigations. And I say this because many of these theorists will be on panels that have to decide these things, and the appreciation of what it takes to keep the business going, to keep the right instrumentation in space, is really important. And this is not an idle detail in terms of maintaining the capacity to respond to black hole opportunities on the timeline. So then we have Jerry Orth's nice picture here of all the 17 galactic black holes where the parameters are reasonable enough to draw the little picture, and these are all scaled. Here's the distance to Mercury, to the Sun, and these are the companion stars color-coded for their surface temperature, and you have the idea there are supergiants and all the way down to these tiny little systems with four-hour binary periods. And this is the secure foundation now with Newtonian gravity from which we can go to the next level and say, well, let's try to go closer into the black hole, let's try to think about general relativity effects, let's try to understand in detail what's going on with these black hole binaries. So how they present themselves to us is shown in this plot here, where we have the X-ray light curve from the All-Sky Monitor, and in the bottom panel, I've taken the pointed PCA observations and shown the derived flux from modeling the spectra, and I use a symbol type to color code and symbol code what state the source is in on each of the pointed observations. And I'm going to continue doing this and using the same symbol scheme throughout the talk so that you can get a sense of how to read these plots and infer what the states are and what's going on. So the red X's are a thermal state, and I'll describe in a minute what that means, but there's spectral evolution during the course of this outburst, and the Steve power law state here in green symbols represents a substantially different energy spectrum and power spectrum compared to the thermal state. And then we have the blue squares, which are hard states, where we think a jet is operating, and then yellow circles in a muted color represent intermediate conditions where, according to our definitions, the source is not clearly in one of the three states at the time of the observation. Now, the tools that we use to define states are the X-ray spectrum and the power density spectrum. We use a very simple model in the X-ray spectrum, just allowing an uncoupled thermal and power law component. And we're doing this deliberately just because we're trying to understand in a scaling sort of way how these two components are present in the X-ray spectrum. It allows the most amount of freedom in how you can then interpret the coupling between the two components. But they're essentially tools to get parameters and then using the parameters to define states. And then the power continuum and the QPOs in the power spectrum are very important. So I'll quickly run through the different looks of the three states. The thermal state, where the energy spectrum here on the left is dominated by this red bit, which is a multi-temperature disk black body model, and most of the energy is in this red component. So it looks like a thermal spectrum. It has a weak power law tail here, and the power density spectrum shows a basically 1 over F power continuum, which is characteristic of turbulent flow in many types of systems and many applications in physics. So this is a very comfortable set of observations here in terms of the standard expectation, the standard accretion disk model. And the scaling arguments, before we get into a specific model, if you just take the scaling and say if matter is in a classical way is falling into circular orbits as it's descending toward the black hole, forgetting the prescription for angular momentum losses, you just have a relationship and expectation here that luminosity will go as r to the minus 2, and we have to keep reminding ourselves what a great opportunity this is, that accretion disk will always tell you what's going on in the inner boundary condition. And it makes the inner boundary condition, of course, very important, but as a pathway to general relativity, you couldn't ask for a better situation where you get to see the enhancement of the rings that are trying to get as close as possible to the black hole. So there are many groups now, both on the theory side and the observational side, that are trying to make this interface on a more exact basis, try to struggle with the issues of the exact inner boundary condition, whether there's magnetic coupling across the boundary or whether or not it more terminates in an ISCO. But the interpretation of these spectra, just in terms of a simple model, will really allow you to scale the size of the inner disk, and with knowledge of the mass of the black hole and the distance, you can start to make inroads on what the dimensionless spin parameter is. So this calibration of the inner disk it's something that is difficult and it has its complexities, but it's one of the aspects where the thermal state is agreeable to application of general relativity, and particularly the dimensionless spin parameter. Now that's all I'm going to say about the thermal state, because the QPOs really are in the non-thermal processes, so let's move on to the second state. Now I've moved up the thermal state for comparison, and I've moved in a new set of data points in the lower panel where there's a distinctly non-thermal spectrum. The index here is around 1.7, and you get a very different look in the power density spectrum. If you add up a ton of thermal states, you get a little tiny bump with an amplitude that's like a few tenths of a percent. That's pretty much it. JURIS 1915 might be the exception where you get the 67 hertz QPO in some things that we would call a thermal state. But in general, it's void, and we define it. So in our world, it's sort of a requirement. So it's a little bit circular. But if you just take, if you define soft spectra, and then try to search for QPOs in those two ways, those are the only QPO present. So here's the hard state. The radio community has done a tremendous job in tying this state to the presence of a steady jet. That's now the mainstream point of view. I don't know of any exceptions that would cause any worry. But when you look at this 1.7 non-thermal spectrum, where the disk now is contributing only a minor fraction in our estimation, we call the hard state, by definition, a set of these three requirements. The disk is contributing less than 20% of the flux at 2 to 20 keV. The power law index of this blue component here in the energy spectrum is 1.7 plus or minus 0.3 rather. And the RMS power in the power density spectrum is greater than 0.1, integrated between 0.1 hertz and 10 hertz. So we have these mathematical prescriptions, and the idea is not to try to pigeonhole every observation. It's to try to show when the conditions seem to favor one of the three spectral components, either the disk, the signature of the jet, or the other non-thermal signature, which I'll describe next. And it's more intended to give guidance to people to do analyses, to think about theoretical models, and to try to make some progress. Because if you mix all these observations up and don't pay attention to some context of states, it's hopelessly complicated, we will never make progress. Sorry? The requirement that we imposed was the RMS is less than 0.07. So it's low. It's a lower limit for the thermal state. And then, there's an upper limit for the thermal state, a lower limit for the hard state. Now, there can be QPOs in the hard state. And when I summarize these properties, I'll mention this again. But especially when the luminosity is high, or when you still see the disk. Some hard states, the disk becomes completely invisible. It just moves to lower temperature, and it comes off the map of what XTE can see. So now for the third state, I've stacked at the top here, because in the probabilistic sense, it's seen often when the sources reach highest luminosity. There's a different type of non-thermal spectrum. You still see the disk, and it often looks quite normal in terms of temperature. Sometimes it looks scattered out in terms of the normalization goes down, as if there's a scattering process and you're looking through some scattering to see the disk. But the disk is quite visible, but the non-thermal component of 2.5 dominates. And GRO showed in the late 90s that this component can go all the way to 1 MeV. In a few sources where they're bright enough to get statistics way out there. So the definition of the steep power law is that gamma, the index here is greater than 2.4, the RMS is less than 0.15, and the disk is either less than 80% of the flux plus its QPOs, or for the sake of SIGX1, the disk is less than 50% of the total flux, because SIGX1 tends to have a low luminosity version of this state that does not have QPOs. Now here's the power spectrum, and this is where it starts getting increasingly interesting. There are three QPOs in this one observation. There's the QPO around 8 hertz. Here, there's one down here, a very slow QPO, less than 0.1 hertz, and then there's the 300 hertz QPO that I'll talk about later as one of the high frequency QPOs that these systems can emit. And QPO action in general is most obvious in this depower law state. Okay, so we can draw little pictures now that go with each state. Here's the hard state, and here's a jet in your model. And now the debate is about how, whether or not the X-rays come from comptonization at the base of the jet, or X-ray synchrotron radiation, or some mixture of the two. But we now have a much more specific context for thinking about the energy spectrum and the power density spectrum of the hard state. And this is the what you should have in your mind when you see a hard state observation. The thermal state is always the same old list it always was, except for this dot in the center, forget that. And the power law state is our big problem. We don't know how to draw it. There's many motivations to consider magnetization, and I'll talk about this later, but you have QPOs at the same time, so you have to find a way to orchestrate the magnetization enough to give you an oscillation that's visible in the line. And that is essentially the core of the rub of where we're sort of stuck in terms of how we can draw this. And so there's an increasing element in the observing community to look toward the GRMHD people and say, well, help us out here and get us the picture. Get us the QPOs, get us the non-thermal accelerations, but that's a good thing. It's a complicated matter, but it's a good thing. I think the interface is much more like lively and close to reality than it ever was before, and that's what we're all about, right? Okay.
One question back up. Is there your thermal spectrum in the very high state? Is that included or is it there?
It almost always is there. It gets damaged a little bit in terms of getting dimmer and dimmer, and as it gets dimmer and dimmer, it looks hotter and hotter. Yeah, there's a Kubota paper that's very nice that shows how for a lot of the steep power law state, the implied radius, color radius, the apparent radius of the disk was very flat until you get to very high luminosities in the non-thermal component, and then the temperature starts to go higher and then the size of the disk starts to go lower. It looks like a Compton fog in some way, where you get some, you know, perhaps some hardening of the spectrum as it emerges out of the atmosphere, and much more Compton upscattering, and therefore a much stronger power law component, and a dimmer looking disk and a harder looking temperature. But Kubota is a nice place to look to see how that plays. So here now is a different source now, where you see some of the same features. For 1550 minus 564, this big double wave outburst, a lot of the highest points are green triangles, which are, again, the steep power law. This source is unusual in having a long episode of intermediate conditions. Most sources don't do that. But it isn't quite sure here if it wants to look hard like this or look steep power law like this. So it has properties that cross over between the two. But then a long episode of a thermal state. But 1550 was the source that showed us that if you take a slice here along a band in luminosity, you can see quite a mixture of states. So as soon as this outburst went off, you started seeing comments, Homan et al., and also in our papers, that the implication here in terms of what the main primary variables are in this process are much more than m dot. Unless we're so completely fooled by efficiency in terms of evaluating m dot by the luminosity, that but I don't think any of the observers think there's any scheme that takes these states and arranges the efficiency issue so that m dot as a primary variable survives. There's something else going on here that allows this to be non-thermal here and here, and down here it can be can be thermal or non-thermal in the two flavors. Yeah. Well, Jerris 1915 plays games that look like these states. If you buy that, it's seconds.
And if you don't buy it,
certainly hours. Say it again, Julian.
With the hour, upper bound, or natural interval?
I don't know we have a good case of a resolved transition. So it's more like hours would involve a data gap. Another source, just quickly to show you these patterns repeat, all these big flares here are steep power law, the long episodes of a thermal state, and some hard states at the beginning and at the end. Now, GX339-4 is a particularly interesting source because it has recurrent outbursts and because it's one of the favorites of the radio community. So I'm showing you this one because I want to then make a quick switch and show you how states are perceived in the radio world and show that there's many features in common, and our definition of states are not at odds with the unified radio model for how these things operate. So here's GX339-4. Here's what the states look like. This shows here that the hard state can extend to very high luminosity. And this source plays all the same tunes, basically, that the other binaries go. Now, in terms of QPOs now, I want to point out that if you just ask in a basic way, what are the features in the X-ray power spectrum? There are quite a number of them. QPOs were defined by Vanderklist as features in the power spectrum that have a Q parameter, or central frequency divided by full width half max, greater than 2. And for black holes, we can divide these into high frequency QPOs, low frequency QPOs, very low frequency oscillations, millihertz. We also have broad power peaks with Qs less than 2. And there are power spectra that are amenable to analysis by multi-Lorentzian in the power spectrum, and there are also high-frequency broad power peaks that are now just being investigated by Mark Kleinbolt and others in 2003. All of these provide opportunities in the eyes of the observer. The problem is how to sort them all out and how to apply them to a specific state in a meaningful way. And I will choose in a little while in this talk the topic of jets and try to run through this process so you can see how the observers would design efforts to make some progress. I will not say anything about the very low frequency oscillations, and I will not say anything about the multi-Lorentzian fits and the global relationships between these broad features and pairs of these broad features that extend from neutron stars all the way to white dwarf. But I'm just going to talk basically about high frequency QPOs and low frequency QPOs. The properties of low-frequency QPOs, I can quickly summarize here. There's a large range in frequencies, large range in amplitudes, large range in the Q value, large range in the phase lags. And so these alone can be rather intimidating, but the solution to this problem is to do state-specific investigations, as I said before, and to accept the fact that there are different types of low-frequency QPOs. And I'll try to make that a little more palatable in a couple of minutes. In terms of states, the hard jet state has QPOs, especially when LX is high or when the disk is visible. The thermal state is basically no, in answer to Elliot's question. The steep power law is yes, almost all the time. And the intermediate states are yes, and some of the intermediate states have the strongest QPOs we've ever seen. Now, in terms of physical correlations, this is the important part of the QPO business. The QPO frequencies of a certain type have shown correlations with disk flux and also with the spectral index of the power law component. So this starts to warm the idea that the QPOs are sort of fundamental to the process and are tied to the radiation patterns that we see in the energy spectrum. The amplitudes, as a function of energy, resemble the power law. QPOs have hard amplitude spectrum. So we're seeing here that the QPOs talk in some sense to both the disk and to the power law component. And that provides some optimism that they can be a key to solving some problems. Now, just to show you how big they can get, I like to show occasionally just these simple light curves. This is 10 seconds times 3 in the life of XTJ 1550. the amplitude of this 4 hertz oscillation gets so strong you can see the individual waves. Now, it's complicated how to do this wave tracking process, but there's a paper by Morgan et al. In 1997 where you can see some effort to see how the wave trains distribute themselves in time and what the implications are in terms of whether or not it's a reservoir type model like a dripping faucet or a random walk model. And there's clear evidence in 1915 it's a random walk model, although we don't know quite what to do with that information. Now, the types of low frequency QP, although it is an annoyance, I'll try to explain why we've been forced into this accepting three types of low frequency QPMs. And there's a whole bunch of references here that you can refer to get more details. It started out with the issue of phase lag. We have more information than we had been using simply in the power spectrum, so we started computing cross spectra to understand what the relationship is between soft X-rays and hard X-rays, particularly when you have two different components, a thermal component and a non-thermal component. And the phase lags started to differentiate three types of QPLs. They seem to be stable in frequency for two types and very variable for the third type. And the third type is the one that had the least phase lag. Now, further investigation of these QPO types started showing correlations between the state. The Steve power law likes the A's and the B's, and the hard intermediate state likes the C's. High frequency QPO coupling, the A's and B's couple to two of the frequency components when high frequency QPOs appear in a 3-to-2 ratio, whereas the C type is uncoupled. So if you accept the pain of separating them into types, you can think about jets in this context and look at C-type QPOs and try to make some progress. And if you think about having sort of sideband oscillations of some process with high frequency QPOs, you have to stay restricted to the A's and the B's. Now, I've plotted here samples of the three, and I've plotted them in nu times p nu units, which is the normal power spectrum rolled up by one frequency power, because it allows you to compare better where the maximum power occurs. And it makes broad features look much more isolated. That's really the another motivation for doing this. Here's the A-type QPO, and here's the high-frequency QPO that it's associated with, the 3 omega. Here's the B-type QPO. It has a very mad harmonic, and it's tied to the 2 omega. And the C-type QPO often sits on a gigantic broad feature, and it has very low power, generally, at high frequency. So this is the look, and this is the way you want to organize it in terms of thinking about how to apply QPOs to physical models and to states. The central frequency of a QPO. Sorry. That nu zero is the high frequency QPO. If the high frequency QPO was coming at 3-to-2 scaling, it's 3-to-2 times a nu zero. And in this case, it was I should probably change the wording. Nu zero maybe is a low frequency QPO center, and let's call it omega for the high frequency QPOs that come in 3 omega, 2 omega. So that's the coupling was that reference to the omega. Jeff McClintock made this plot of two different sources, showed with two different colors here, and tried to examine the relationship between QPO frequency and the disk flux and QPO frequency and the photon index. The open symbols are the A's and the B's, and the filled symbols are the C types. So you can see in this insert box here that the C's, the filled symbols, really scale very well for these two sources against disk flux. And the correlation is totally damaged if you consider the A's and the B's. On the other hand, the A's and the B's, here are the A's and there are the B's, tend to be more stable in frequency. So you have sort of an 8 hertz thing going on, although there's certainly some outliers in the A's, and a 6 hertz thing going on, and then another set of QPOs that correlate well, similarly here. And for other sources, there are papers by Bologna et al. Where the correlation looks better on the photon index side of the of these diagrams. But this portion of it shows you that the type C QPO is really connected to the energetics of the disk, and the A's and the B's look to be. So now, what are the models? If you do the exercise of writing down on one page all the models that have come up to talk about QPOs, there are quite a variety, and some even authors present here. But on the other hand, we have different types of QPOs, so maybe more than one of these apply. Now, I don't think we're at the stage yet where we can advocate a particular model. We can only really advocate that we're in a complicated situation, but we have a real opportunity here and a better understanding of the context with which to apply analyses. So rather than get into the details of all these models, which I certainly don't have time to do, I'm going to choose a theme and I'm going to go back to the data and try to step through to see how selecting the timing features for a particular state can be a productive exercise. Okay, so let's go back now. So the topic here is sorting out timing features versus states. I'm going to go back to something I already showed you, GX339-4 with the states on a timeline, 1996 to 2006. You can rearrange the same data with the same symbols on the diagram preferred by other groups in defining states, and especially the radio community likes to look at color intensity diagrams. And here's the same data shown on that diagram. So all the hard states are all in the hard zone, which is nice. And on the soft side, there's a mixture, in our view, of two different states, a thermal state and a non-thermal state. And where we tend to differ in our descriptions is that, from the point of view of the radio community, this is the jet and is important, and this is all soft, and they would prefer to just call it soft and not pay as much attention to the difference between the greens and the reds, which is the thermal state and the steep power law state. But from the X-ray point of view, you can't do that because one is thermal, one is non-thermal, one has QPOs, including high-frequency QPOs, and to interpret those, we need a model that is very specific to those conditions, and the thermal state doesn't do it. In terms of MHD, I think what we've seen so far is quite happy with the red X's. So we want to find a pathway now. What can we do to change the situation, to start investigating in a serious way the blue zone, which is a quasi-stable configuration connected to a steady jet, and this very interesting green zone where we see high-frequency QPOs. So the radio community's are influenced by GX339, I think, obviously in this diagram, in the way they present the unified model for radio states, the hard state, the circulations. It really looks like GX339-4, which is fine. And what we pointed out at the Texas Symposium is where the jet line is. The idea here is that you have a steady jet here. When you cross over in the intermediate state, and intermediate in their definition is between hard and soft. When you cross over this line, you stop having a jet. And when you get near the line, the probability of putting off an impulsive jet becomes very high. So the line is like an instability strip where you fire off 0.9C plasmoids, and this is stable, and this is stable, and this steep power law is another variation of stability which only we push on. There's a state transition that I think coincides with the jet line. The far boundary of all of these green points separated from the circles, and now here I've done one different thing. I've taken the intermediate states, the circles, and I've color-coded them into which two they look to be between. Where the yellow circles are between the thermal and the steep power law, the black circles are between the hard state and the steep power law, and this one magenta circle looks like it's between the thermal and the hard state. So I think we're making progress here in unifying the schemes of understanding these things and giving some guidance to how we're going to solve the problem. And from the observer's eyes, this problem is solved. It's the standard accretion disk. This problem of the configuration of the steady jet is what is highly interesting. It's much is known about that now, but it didn't at all solve how it works. This is the worst case where it's completely unknown how you make power law state. But we have the added guidance now that we think when you go from one state to the other and you cross this line, you're going to fire off jets. So if you can solve this and then solve that, then you can look at the transition, as we heard yesterday from Professor Matsumoto, as being a great place to see where the impulsive jet works. Now, because we use three parameters to define states, it's kind of interesting to take the same diagram now, because hardness ratio, the hard color separates all these states, and look at the three parameters versus the hard color and see if we can find something interesting. So we have the power law index, we have the diffraction, and we have the RMS power. Now, this looks, what we're looking for is a step across the boundary here of the jet line at 0.45. Now, the power law flips between the two states, and that's part of the definition of the two states. The power law index has to be around 1.7 to be called hard, has to be around 2.5 to be called steep power law, so you get a shift near the boundary. I don't think we've learned anything from there. We just are seeing, echoing the behavior of these things being preferring those two indices. We don't know why. The diffraction climbs as you go to the thermal state. Well, everyone knew that. There's no new information here. But what I think is interesting here is this RMS power, and plots like this are also being shown now by Homan and Bologna, and there's a big change here at the point where you have a state transition between the intermediate state and the steep power law state. Now, what I think is very interesting is the frequency composition and not just the RMS power. If I say, well, what do the SPLs look like on average for GX339-4 and plot it in nu p nu units again, I see a sort of 1 over f underlying power, and I see a QPM. There was this huge feature in the hard intermediate states on the other side of the boundary. This is the same broad feature that's talked about in terms of the global scaling relationships between neutron stars and white dwarfs. What seems odd in the comment that we made at the Texas Symposium is this feature really should be thought of as something to do with the jet and not the disk, not the normal Shakura-Sanyaev or any variant of a thermal radiating disk. The jet is here and it loses this big broad feature when it goes across the boundary that I think is the jet line into the steep power law state. So I think people that do models in particular, the concept of magnetic acceleration within the disk should really look to this as a broad timing signature of the steady jet. So whether you can concoct Alphane waves or whether you can do something with spiral waves to create some dispersion relation in terms of frequency that would get you this thing is the challenge now. But this is the consequence of trying to do the state-specific exercise of following the timing properties through, sorting them by state, looking for transitions, and then comparing things on both sides of the transition. Okay, now I'm going to make a few more comments, and I have to accelerate the process quickly, but I just want to show you that in this display of hardness intensity, there are very different looks than the circular, the pattern of the unified model. So you have to have some tolerance that some sources will stay in the two soft states. Other sources will just do a hard episode. And other sources, here's 1550, do very complicated things in this diagram. Okay, now I'm going to say a few things about high-frequency QPOs. There's not a lot of change here. So basically, these are the basics. I think these are all, as far as I know, the published or announced high-frequency QPO power density spectra back in PNU units available. And they're weak oscillations, they're hard to detect. You can't detect them on every observation when they're at the level of 1% just for statistical reasons. So we have to struggle with that issue. If you make a table of all the frequencies, you see that there are certain pairs that have a 3-to-2 ratio. And the idea of stable frequency systems with that are commensurate, integral relation 3-2 has created a lot of excitement. People are looking towards resonance models. Bromwitz and Kluzniak have a resonance model based on blob orbits. Jeremy Schnittman has done ray tracing to see if this is a viable way to produce QPOs, and he'll be talking later today, and he'll show you that it is a viable model. There's still the question of how to drive these things, and again, the tendency to look to the MHD people and say, well, we don't know what forces that will pile things up at a resonance radius, which is a critical part of this model. Can you help us out? And if we see simulations going by with little spiral waves flying through this, you know, the observers tend to get all excited and want to know more about these spiral waves in MHD. There's a new model from Cato talking about resonances with a global disk warp. Don't have time to discuss that in any detail. Plus, there are other models. And I'm going to jump ahead and show only two more slides. First, there's some excitement about the whole process here when you compare what the frequencies are of the high-frequency system. So I'm not back to omega now, where one black hole binary shows 2 omega, 3 omega. You just plot the 2 omega versus black hole mass, Newtonian gravity, and ask, can I draw a 1 over m line through these data points? You can. Now, there are only three, and I shouldn't even have a 1 over m relationship in GR unless they had the same spin. But at least it didn't have to turn out this way. At least to the extent that we have scant information, it's very encouraging toward following this track of high-frequency QPOs as essentially GR systems that scale as a 1 over m relation. So let me jump ahead to conclusions. The high-frequency QPOs in black hole binaries, there's subtle oscillations. They're stable to at least 15% to a commensurate frequency systems in four cases. The other cases, we just have only one QPO, so we can't make a statement about this. They seem promising as a GR voice print of black hole mass and spin, but we need a model. And we need a model for the steep power law because that's where they occur and we don't understand it. For the low-frequency QPOs, they're multi-typed and variable, but their behavior is highly patterned. The A's and B's seem to be signatures of a steep power law state, and the type C's and the broad peaks seem to be signatures of a steady jet. Non-thermal states require aggressive investigations of any magnetic instability models in GR-MHD, and we like low beta because it has to go that way to become non-thermal, we think, if magnetization is at the core of these processes. And finally, ballistic jets are further linked to the instability strip, as you heard yesterday from Professor Matsumoto. Thank you. Sorry for going over.
Okay, questions, comments? Mitch, wait for the microphone. I didn't realize you had to be fit to be session chair.
What are the largest Qs that you measure?
For low-frequency QPOs, 20. For 67 hertz, which is the orphan now, don't understand, it's not connected to the other high-frequency QPOs, the Q is 30, maybe 35. So they can be quite impressive. That's on time scales of thousands of seconds, say 5,000.
Okay, Eric? Wait.
Wondering if the states themselves show any periodicity. So if you plot the state repetition as a function of time, is there any cyclic frequency to the appearance of various?
In general, no. There are the shapes of the outbursts have a lot of freedom, and so although there's a probabilistic relation of what state you might be in at a given luminosity, because the states are so sort of willful, you don't really get oscillations.
Okay.
So I have a question about time correlation between the jet and the QPO. So so jet preceded QPO or QPO preceded jet, or so other way around, which one?
If the source is in a high luminosity version of the hard state, as soon as we see anything, we see a QPO. In the lower luminosities, you don't always see a QPO, and it's confused by the transition. If you look at GRS 1915, where things happen really quickly, as soon as it drops into a hard state and the radio cycle comes on, especially in the 30-minute cycles of the beta type light curves in the Bologna classifications, the QPOs come on instantly. So at high luminosity, they seem to be coupled immediately. And at low luminosity, it's a harder question to ask because the transitions take so long.
I'll use Chair's privilege here. You talked about the QPOs not being present in the thermal dominant states where the disk is very obvious in the spectrum. But you also said that the QPOs are increased with energy. They're connected to the power law. So in those spectra where you have a thermal dominant component, you have very little power law flux. Have you tried looking at a QPO signature in the power law flux and correcting it for this thermal dominant, which is known to be very low variability, a different spectral component?
Yeah, it doesn't follow the dilution fraction
right.
of the count rate scheme. And in particular, if you can look at times when the spectrum is completely dominated by the steep power law. So the disk is not even a substantial contributor on those days in the 2 to 6 keV band, you still see a striking increase in the QPO fraction, where it's very common to ignore 2 to 6 keV in terms of signal to noise, even when the steep power law is dominating at all wavelengths. So there is a profile there. I don't think the far end has been clearly mapped, but many of the efforts to deconvolve the count rates the way, as you suggest, show a curved relationship in terms of percent of the QPO scale to only the power law component.
I wanted to ask you to go back to that slide where you compared your classification scheme with the one that Fender had output, which just wasn't completely clear. And while you're doing it, you kept talking about magnetic effects, and I, of course, am a great proponent of it, but I didn't see, it wasn't clear to me in anything that you said why it, if I didn't know the word magnetic, why would I come up
yeah.
with it?
Well, I would argue it the following way. There is somewhat of a widespread assumption that to build a jet, you better have a role for the magnetic field. That's on this side of the house, okay? If you have QPOs that survive this passage, or if you go from one type of QPO to another type of QPO when you cross this line, and you're still staying non-thermal, there's a temptation to think that, well, if I have to build an entire different mechanism, if I know it rests on the foundation of the jet community thinking magnetic fields are important, if you accept that, on this side, and you look at transitions and look at QPO properties, if you have to build a whole different mechanism that is non-magnetic to understand QPOs over here, it seems like you're not taking the simplest approach. I know I have QPOs here. I know I have QPOs here. I know I have non-thermal processes here and there. They're different. And I see in the transition that one is kind of giving away to another. That drags in the temptation of having a different magnetic configuration, maybe a different beta zone, I don't know. But it seems more a simpler and natural way to deal with the fact that this side has jets and can have QPOs, and this side has no jets, but it still has QPOs, and I don't see a profound change in properties. It's more like a cousin, so you want to make it a magnetic cousin. That's as far as I can go. It's only an intuitive.
Okay. No. So I was actually referring to the other 23 there, your slide number 23.
Oh.
So I thought there was some statement that was being made about when you make the transition across that jet line, some things, there's like a precursor that you get to see in the state before you cross.
if you look at, now on a timeline, if you look at studies of several of these binaries as they go across, as they sit in this thing and then go in and out. So consider a loop now where something does this, or a circulation like this. There are nice papers by Fender, Corbell, et al. That look at the temporal evolution of the jet and the X-ray spectrum. What you see is, as you ingress into the hard state, you see a big radio flare and a big X-ray flare. And in some cases, these events have led to VLBI detections of the supraluminal expanding knots. When you egress from that state, the same thing can happen, perhaps a little less violently, but so you see a flat hard state with horns, where the radio plot shows giant radio flares. And the accumulation of these cases has led to this sense of the jet line, where you make a loop like this and you cross an instability strip in some multi-parameter space, blast off your ballistic jets, settle into the hard state with a steady jet, and then when you go back out, you seem to travel through this same surface and blast off some more, and then settle into one of the soft states. It's the coverage is really spotty. It's not like you can arrange VLBI and these things.
Hang on, wait for the microphone. So the question is about whether you see jets as you come from the soft state to the hard state, whether those also have jet ejection.
Now, if you take the cases, there's only a handful of VLBI expansions of the knots, and you map them back into whether they were an egress or an ingress into one of these hard states, I just don't think, well, I haven't done that, so I don't know the answer to your question. But we don't have a lot of chances to map where they go. They may be. It wouldn't surprise me that one was an ingress and one was an egress.
I'm going to close the discussion there because it's coffee time. If we come back here for 11:30, so there's plenty of time over coffee to continue discussions. Thank you.